When I first heard the news about Aria, it was as if she had re-entered my life instead of exiting it forever. Hey friends, how you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am very, very grateful that you've tuned in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine from their Department of First Stories, a story written by Christina Holling. It's called The Making of Friends. I had no plan when I first bought the house next door. The house itself was one in a long row of townhomes, distinguished more by their numbers than their features. Two long, high windows were cut out of the siding on the left side, and one on the right. All the front of the house was flat, which was more than could be said about the door in the middle, with the top half of the screen arching its back. The five steps leading up to it were made of cracked concrete that grew more grass than the rest of the yard put together. I had observed hail damage on the siding, toppled beer cans by the fence corner, grass that was patchy when it was grass at all. I had no plan, but I wouldn't pretend I didn't know who lived next door. My first afternoon there, I glanced through the window to see him taking out the trash, and spying on him like that for some reason made me feel unusually clever. I think it was just that the sight of him doing such a very homey task made me feel that I had outsmarted him already. It was a little like feeling a judge is about to rule in your favor and the attorney at the table beside you hasn't even guessed it. I hovered and watched, then stepped outside, my bare feet finding their way between the weeds that had fought through the sidewalk. I hadn't brought a trash bag, and for the moment, I couldn't think what else I might be doing out there without a rake or a weed puller. I settled for dropping to the ground and doing a kind of vague hand sweep, intended to gather up a few papers and cigarettes in the vicinity. My new neighbor turned around. My heart lifted a little. I'd been waiting for this moment. I didn't know till that moment whether he would recognize me, but I'd sworn off social media years ago, and even if Aria had ever mentioned my name to him, it didn't seem like she'd shown him any photos. I saw, with some surprise, that Everard wasn't tall, not that much taller than me, I thought, and though I knew we were both in our mid-30s, he looked a little older. He had a long, pasty face, the kind of face that made you look twice because you expected him to have sideburns, dark hair and meandering eyebrows like someone out of Pride and Prejudice. Or Dracula. "I think we're neighbors," he said. "Yes, I think so too," I said, and then I smiled quickly for fear I had sounded sarcastic. Yes, I was glad we were neighbors, and yes, I was glad he hadn't recognized me as anything else. That wouldn't have been the end of it, but it wouldn't have been ideal either. I still hadn't even decided whether to tell him my real name. My eyes drifted toward his parking spot, some kind of electric car. I knew big and bright and shiny black. I wondered why a man in a neighborhood like this had a car like that. Then I heard the screen door squeal, and I turned around just as a child appeared, perhaps 3 or 4. My heart lurched. Like Aria, she was dark-eyed and dark-haired. I could easily enough believe she was part Persian. And for a confused moment, I thought Aria had not only a husband, but also a daughter I had never met. But that was impossible. 3 years ago, she and Everard didn't know each other. "This is Emma," I heard Everard saying, and the child shrank back a little in front of me, a stranger. She must be some other child from some previous relationship. But it was a child whom Arya must have mothered. Arya, herself the childish type, used to hold that child's hand crossing streets. Everard had moved on. "You got your work cut out for you, don't you?" he was saying. I didn't need to look around the yard to know what he meant. "Yes, I guess I do. The inside's like this too, I'm afraid." He nodded. "Well, let me know if you ever need help." When I first heard the news about Arya, it was as if she had re-entered my life instead of exiting it forever. I would see a familiar face on the streets, in the mall, at the restaurant, and every time there would be a moment when I had to recall whose face it was, and then again the impossibility of it being her. I kept coming up with alternate histories. Suppose I'd never moved. Suppose I'd done a better job keeping in touch with my childhood friends. And then, suppose Arya had tried harder. Suppose she had reached out to me when things got worse. Of course, by then it was far too late. I only knew about her death at all because of my mother. "Oh, you probably heard about Arya, didn't you? It was very sad. Apparently the two of them were out hiking, and she must have slipped." That must have been a few months after she'd called to tell me about Everard himself. "Did you know Arya got married?" I'd had to hide the pain in my voice, even then, as I answered, "No, I hadn't heard. How nice." There is a feeling, when you lose touch with someone, that they don't belong to you anymore. And when I heard about the wedding, I accepted this. I was a little hurt, but I had no right to be. I rummaged around for the BFF bracelet Arya had given me when we were 10, only to find its beads looking rather forlorn. But once Arya was really gone, I kept seeing her everywhere. It wasn't till then that I found out how quickly the wedding had taken place, a whirlwind elopement a few months after they'd met. I took Everard up on his offer for help several times over the next few months. We got to know each other slowly. Slowly, because I had always been the handy type, and I needed a little help, and because the role of the seductress did not come naturally to me. I didn't play tricks with my eyes, and I didn't smile unless I felt like it, and I did not have the makeup abilities to make either my eyes or my smile more than they were. So I was not trying to seduce him. A man who had been with a woman as lovely as Arya wasn't likely to be vulnerable to that kind of thinking anyway. What I was doing was making friends. His daughter used to come over and help me with my yard, pick dandelions, catch grasshoppers, that kind of thing. She was a small and busy child whom it was something of a crime to keep indoors. Maybe Everard thought that too, because he didn't seem to mind sending her over. As little as he knew me, it made me wonder if he trusted all strangers like this. I thought of Arya, and I thought Arya never wanted a child. Arya should have had a child, but she never was the mothering type. But all the same, Arya would never have let her child go off and play in a stranger's backyard. One evening, late in the fall, I was making soup when my doorbell rang. I had begun with a recipe, as I usually did, the measuring cups and timers and thermometers. I had laid out all the spices, sniffed a little, and scattered them in a pot. Then I turned to the sugar and the vinegar and the garlic and the onions. This was the way Arya would cook, I thought, although we had lost touch soon after high school, and I didn't think I had ever seen her navigate a kitchen other than to slap together a sandwich. It took a minute before I answered. By the time I got there, he had rung several more times. Outside, I found Everard, hand on the doorframe, his body seeming almost to fill it. I hadn't remembered him being so large. He hadn't come to my door before. We had only met each other in the yard, and the shock of seeing him there so nearly in my house made me want to slam the door in his face. But I didn't. "Everard, is Emma here?" he said. His voice sounded artificially casual. "No, I..." He didn't wait for my answer, but turned and bounded down my steps. I called after him, "Is she playing with the kids down the street?" He didn't answer, probably didn't hear. I stepped out the back door to my yard, taking a quick survey of the property. She was there, of course, crouching in the shady corner by the far side of my porch, staring into her hands, mesmerized and quivering slightly with the fear of whatever it was she held. She flinched when I called Everard, then came toward me like she knew she was in trouble. "I got a ladybug," she said. "Oh, and it's a big one. I think it's the biggest ever. You're holding it carefully, it looks like." She looked up at me suddenly, and for a moment I thought that she was going to crumple the insect in her fist. Everard must have heard us because he came running around the corner and stopped short when he saw us. He circled around me and picked Emma up. "My wife died half a year ago," he said, "pretty suddenly." I wasn't sure why he needed to explain not wanting to lose his child, but I ducked my head in what was intended to be a sympathetic manner. I was still watching Emma. A chill had set into the evening air, and she snuggled into his arms eagerly enough, fingering his cheek. He started to walk away and turned back. "We'll be out of town tomorrow to visit my mom." "Oh, are you going to be gone long?" "About a week." A week was fine. A week was very, very decent length of time. "Oh, a week," I said. "Do you want me to water your plants, feed your dog, anything like that?" "I don't have a dog." Arya would have wanted a dog. "As a matter of fact, though, you could look in on the place if you're around and you remember." "Oh, I'll remember." "Let me get you the keys." He found his way past my yellow grass and thistles and crossed into his yard, still carrying Emma. I trailed after, unsure if I was supposed to follow or not. I wondered if Arya had ever done this, if she had ever taken small uneven steps as Everard walked on ahead, silent steps for the most part, but for the occasional scuffling on the concrete path, just to let him know that she was there because she didn't know for sure that he knew. The front door was open when I got there, the house exhaling that faintly stuffy smell that breathes from anyone's house other than your own. I glanced left and right, asked myself what I was scanning for, and stepped across the threshold because here was as good a place as any to wait for Everard. I could hear him around the corner rummaging in some drawer. Meanwhile, I stood in a narrow entryway, the crumb-littered floor lit up by the late afternoon light falling in behind me. The hall took a quick turn to the right and up a set of stairs. There was just room enough in the foyer for a dangling yellow chandelier, laughably grotesque, and a long, smudged mirror several inches too low for Everard. I pictured him spraying the glass while Emma looked up at him or dragged a stool over to help. It was harder to imagine Arya here, picking up toys, rubbing at the stain on the mat, playing the all-knowing mother and wife, but, after all, playing. Had Everard ever suspected this? Or to him had the housework been a serious matter, the subject of meals, of preoccupation to be discussed, under the assumption that it made some kind of difference, whether they had stir-fry or spaghetti? Of course, maybe it was always like that. That only your friends refused to take you seriously long after you had earned the right in everyone else's eyes. It was hard to think of Arya as mother and wife, because thinking of her I could not take my mind off her large Emma-like eyes, the immense vulnerability of her. And yet to Arya, even that chandelier must have seemed serious enough, maybe especially the chandelier. Everard came back to find me standing there, concentrating on averting my eyes from the long mirror, when in fact there was really no other place to look. He dropped a set of keys into my hand. I tried to keep my fingers from shaking as they closed over the shiny plastic keychain I had once brought Arya back from New York. Just if you look in, or whatever, he was saying. He had given the key a second glance before I took it, and unless I was wrong, his voice was trailing off, and very possibly he was already realizing that a very weird thing it was to hand over your dead wife's keys to a just-about stranger. One way or another, I had ended up in family law, and over the years my job had steadily turned into what I didn't want to do. Suits and offices and children and victims who wouldn't be repaid ever for what they had lost. I hadn't quit my job, but I wasn't working hard at it either, and some days it felt like I was waiting to be fired. Disinterested was my mother's diagnosis the last time I saw her. Disinterested in work, disinterested in relationships, and more or less morphing into a considerable recluse. She was a bit right, but she was wrong that I was disinterested in everything. I was friends with Everhard, for instance, or rather, I was planning to be. The first night Everard was gone on his trip, I was out till 9. It was half an hour later when I pulled up. His house and mine formed a patch of dark among the jack-o'-lantern homes of the rest of the street. I got out and walked up his driveway, his front steps, through his front door, past his chandelier and his mat. Inside, the house felt a little chilly. He must have turned down the thermostat before leaving. I walked up the half-staircase from the door, flinching in its cold, its darkness. At the top I scanned for a light switch, but the switches must have been at the bottom by the door. No matter, there was still enough twilight to see by. Off to the right was the living room, nicely furnished with brown leather couches, a closed TV cabinet, and a mushroomy kind of coffee table. Arya's doing, maybe. Also a teddy bear, dinosaurs, and dolls in various states of dress were scattered over the floor. I gathered them up, along with several other homeless-looking plastic parts of something, and dropped them in the bin in the corner. I found my way to the kitchen and flicked a switch. On the counter were an enormous orange toaster, a polka-dot popcorn maker, and a square metal device outlandishly red and white striped with large letters that read, "Snack Wicker." I turned from these quickly, dragged my thoughts away from who had selected them and who would have used them. Who had thought they would make a cheery kitchen? After all, I knew nothing about Everard's decorating proclivities, just that he was a widower, just that he was raising a 3-year-old, just that he had convinced Arya to marry him, and that one way or another he had surely killed her. My hands were beginning to tremble, but I was supposed to be here. I was checking up on the house. Checking up started with pulling out the kitchen drawers one by one, but all I found in the first one was silverware, and all I found in the second was the usual assortment of papers, pencils, some nails, and what looked like a broken Happy Meal toy. A few lotto tickets, too. I skimmed my way through a few grocery receipts and a number of stray sticky notes before I stuffed them back in the drawer and slammed it shut. Not sticky notes. Stickies were too much a testimony to the thoughts that might get away from him. Too much an invasion of the day-to-day. For the first time since I had entered the house, It was not Arya's eyes I felt, frozen in their gaze, trusting me and me only. Just now it was Everhart's eyes boring into me. That moment when he thought Emma was lost. I shouldn't have come. What did I expect to achieve? I had walked brazenly into the house of a bereaved man and explored it. He had had no parties since I had known him, no visitors except the occasional parent dropping off a playmate for Emma. Maybe he had no friends. Maybe he didn't want to see them. Either way, it was impossible to imagine couples sitting on these couches or lounging around the barbecue in the backyard. It was hard to picture Everhart having friends, and yet surely a single dad must have friends, real friends. I winced at that phrase, single dad. There was something in it vaguely heroic, something he hardly deserved, but there it was. Before I'd moved in, I'd imagined Everhart as overpowering. I'd given him half a dozen personalities, alternated between them in my mind, and in the end settled on some monstrous coalescence of them all. But for the moment, all I could see was him with Emma. I saw him large and fatherly and domestic. Take away all that, and I couldn't remember his personality at all. He seemed to exist only as a void where Arya ought to have been. I turned around to glance at the popcorn maker and the sandwich toaster and even a little mushroom table. I locked up the house and went home in a hurry, and it was only when I had closed the front door behind me that I remembered what an unsentimental man Everhart was, that the man who handed over his dead wife's keys had surely relinquished any claim to his home's privacy. The problem with Arya, and the attraction of Arya, was that she didn't think of things, so I knew exactly how Everhart would have proposed. Arya would have been vulnerable to that kind of a thing. She would have fallen for him head over heels. He would have seized a delicate moment. He would have proposed in a way that seemed so impulsive, so delectable, that she would have been unable to resist. She would have leaned forward when he asked the question. She wouldn't be outdone, and if he'd asked her to marry him next week, she would have shivered and bit her lip, and she would have said, "Why not tonight?" She would have been happy enough to live in this neighborhood, and she wouldn't have asked Everhart questions on why they needed to marry so quickly. How great were his debts, for instance, or how large was the life insurance policy they were purchasing for her? Or by the time she did, it would have been too late. I stayed away from the house until Friday, allowing myself 4 days to get over my squeamishness. 4 days too many, really, because this was longer than the house sitter was supposed to leave a place vacant. So maybe it was for Everhart's sake that I finally went back. There was no indulgence this time, no craven, sordid submission to tricks of the mind. I went straight to the desk in his bedroom and began a somewhat ritualistic pulling out of drawers. There was a dreadful misery about all of this, but there was also an intoxication. More receipts, paper postcards, coupons for window cleaning, chargers of every description, and a stray credit card statement. I scanned the entries. The last was littered with what I had expected to find. A furniture store, a casino, a dealership. The kind of places that took your money, and not slowly, and the balance carried over was large enough to make me wince. I slammed the last drawer shut and strode to the bookshelf toward the framed photo of Arya. I picked it up and ran my finger along it. He had taken it in front of a little cafe, and Arya, close to the camera, was squinting as if she had been caught unawares by the sun and the camera alike. Her hair had that raw look to it, unstraightened, uncurled, and to me she looked faintly irritated. Beside the photo, there were textbooks on the shelf, actual textbooks, which had to mean they were from university days. For all I knew, they were Arias. It struck me as nothing short of unbelievable that anyone, let alone a young widower, would keep a house full of junk the way this man did. Any moment, in any drawer, in any book, he might come across traces of the dead. He couldn't help it. The thought nauseated me. It was like taking Aria and preserving her skeleton in some kind of Victorian medical museum. Even here, though, there were little smudges of Emma. Dr. Seuss beside Aria's photo, a finger painting drawing of the three of them. In fact, her slipper was under the bed, just protruding. I pulled it out and saw my hand trembling. Aria had made this house, I thought, and Emma had left her traces all over it. What was missing was Everard, his personality, an absence in this place. Everything I knew of him, I knew by guesswork and calculation. What was I doing here, anyway? What was I expecting, a signed confession? The floor creaked, and for the 10th time I jumped. I walked to the closet. Arya's clothes, at least, were gone. He had done that much. The closet was his, and I felt a little sick to my stomach. I thought I heard another creak and froze to listen to the house. A light turned on outside the bedroom on the stairs, maybe? A light I hadn't turned on because it hadn't been dark enough when I came in. It couldn't be him. Of course, there was no way it could be him, because he had told his time was coming back tomorrow. What was our agreement? Could it be a break-in? But an intruder wouldn't flick on the lights. I wondered if I ought to hide, or if he'd already detected from the outside that a light was on up here. The blinds were closed, but I supposed you could see through them. It was dark, after all. Which side of the house was I on? For the moment, I couldn't remember. Another light came on. It was too late anyway. His steps thumped down the hallway, and still he didn't call out. When he showed up at the threshold, I was facing him, feet apart, arms hanging at my sides, eyes watching him, and my tongue running along the inside crevices of my teeth. He looked surprised, but only faintly. Then the surprise faded from his face. He took a step toward me, a slow, measured step. He still had not said anything. There was a long vein running from his face down to his neck, and I watched it tighten and release. His eyes were drawing closer together. The silence was thick, and I knew now that I had not known 5 seconds ago that I did not imagine it, that even now he was thinking his way through this silence as I was doing the same, and I had waited too long to speak, had appeared too unnatural, and he was thinking that this moment was not a simple matter of him having surprised me while I checked the house for flooding or break-ins. What I was thinking was that I was face to face with a man I thought a murderer, and we were looking in each other's eyes for a preposterous length of time, an exorbitant time because I could feel it was costing me secrets. Watching him, watching me, I could see my message sinking into his eyes. "I don't know how you did it," I was telling him. "I don't know if you pushed her off that mountain or if somehow you drove her to it. All I know is Aria died miserably, inelegantly, and now you live at peace with that? That is, you did until now. But here I am. Look at me here. I've come tracking you down." I took a step back, and he took another step forward. "I came checking up on the house," I said. There was a tautness to him I had not seen before, an expectancy almost as if someone coming upon something he had come upon before and knowing what was expected of him. I had torn my nail and began to pick at it. My arm dropped to my side, and even that he took in, even the minute fidgeting of my hand. I didn't dare to step back because his steps were longer than mine, and every step I took brought me closer to a corner of the room, and him closer to me. I came checking on the house, and everything is just fine, of course. How was your time? Didn't you bring Emma? Actually, where is she? What was your name? He said, and again that muscle worked its way down the left side of his face. I hadn't expected that. Something about the question struck me as slightly off. At least here and now, I couldn't laugh it off quite, though. He wasn't going to let me. I wished I could flirt it off. Allison, I said, and proceeded to laugh a little, because, of course, we had introduced ourselves before, and what an odd time to ask a person's name. He said, Allie. And unexpectedly, I was relieved. If he knew my nickname, it at least meant Arya had talked about me. He dropped his gaze and stepped toward me, then very slowly circled halfway around, so he was behind me now. He was staring at the picture on the shelf. I cast a glance toward the door. I was no longer cornered, but I was close enough to hear his breathing or to brush against him, and I still could not make myself leave. What I wanted was a weapon. Just in case, I probably should have been glad that there was nothing sharp lying around by virtue of the fact that neither of us could use it. But I was not. In my mind, I tried to argue away the possibility of a knife concealed in a shelf or a drawer, but for all I knew, it was there. He had kept it there. He had known I was coming and had come to meet me. He had come home early on purpose. Perhaps he had recognized me from the moment we met and had asked me to look after his house on purpose, waiting to find me in here. I edged back slightly, and he spun around. The closeness of him startled me. I was startled by the short scar on his cheek, by the shine on his forehead, the fine wrinkles near his mouth and eyes. The yellow bulbs above us felt suddenly big and bright, and the ceiling close. There was too much light for that small, hot room. "You recognized the photo?" he said. "Yes, I did. Though I did not know how he knew, I must have set it back on a shelf at a different angle than usual, or maybe my glance had given me away." He didn't say anything. "Strange we never met," I went on, "but I suppose she died very soon after you married." I looked away to the rest of the room, the long, dizzy patterns of geometric wallpaper, the long, crooked slats of the blinds on the window. When I looked back, his face looked the same as it had since I last looked at him, and all the harshest light of that room was still concentrated in the short space between us. "It must have been hard for Emma," I said, "getting another mother. Then having her gone, she must rely on you all the more." He seemed to realize how close he was standing and stepped back. "I left Emma with her grandma for a little while," he said to me, but his eyes had wandered past me and I had the sense that he was confused. Maybe he was drunk, I thought. And then I thought that if he was, I would have smelled it on his breath. He had stood so close. I was glad for the moment that Emma wasn't here, but I'd hardly ever seen him without seeing Emma too, and it was strange seeing him alone. I thought, would Arya have been overwhelmed by Emma, the need of her, the fragility, the clamoring for attention? But now all of that fell on Everard. "I was overseas at the time," I said finally, "for the funeral and everything. And then I suppose I didn't know how to reach out. I never did have your number." I shuffled toward the door. I'll leave the keys on the counter.
Thank you, he said, turning to me, and I had the same sense again that he was confused. He didn't know what he was saying.
I'll see you later, I said, but I said it slowly.
Of course I was right. I was right about many things, but I was right that I would see him later. I was keeping an eye on Emma, and I was keeping an eye on that empty space where Arya used to exist. Every so often I would find myself alone with Emma in Arya's house. I pulled out drawers and pushed them in again. I went back to the desk, too, eventually, but the papers were gone. I couldn't tell if Everhard knew my suspicions. There was an innocence about him, a mildness that couldn't seem to cling to a grief or a grudge or a worry. But maybe he did know, and maybe he thought it was the price he paid now for a friendship.
It's now my pleasure to bring you a story from the Alfred Hitchcock Best Mystery Book, The Big Book. Story by Jack Ritchie, and it's called The Third Call. At 1:20 in the afternoon, I phoned Stevenson High School and got through to Principal Morrison. I spoke through a handkerchief over the mouthpiece. "This is no joke. A bomb is going to explode in your school in 15 minutes. There were a few seconds of silence on the other end of the line, and then Morrison's angry voice demanded, "Who is this?" "Never mind that. I'm not fooling this time. A bomb is going off in 15 minutes. And then I hung up. I left the gas station, crossed the street, and returned to the main police station. I took the elevator to the third floor. My partner, Pete Torgerson, was on the phone when I entered the squad room. He looked up. "Yeah, Stevenson High School just got another one of those calls, Jim. Morrison is having the school evacuated. Again."
"Did you get the bomb squad?"
"I'm doing that right now."
He dialed and completed the call to room 121, giving them details. The enrollment at Stevenson was 1,800, and all the students were out of the building by the time we arrived. Their teachers followed the instructions we had given them the last two times the school had received phone calls. We're keeping them at least 200 feet away from the building. Principal Morrison was a large, graying man wearing rimless glasses. He left the group of teachers at the curb and came forward.
"Well, the call came in at exactly 1:20, he said. "The bomb unit truck and two squad cars pulled up behind our car. My son David lounged against the wire fence with a half a dozen of his buddies. He waved.
"What is it, Dad? Another bomb scare?"
I nodded. "And let's hope it's nothing more than a scare this time, too."
Dave grinned.
"I don't mind a bit. We were just going to have a history exam."
Morrison shook his head.
"I'm afraid that most of the students regard this as nothing more than a welcome break in the routine."
Several more details of men arrived from headquarters, and we began searching the building. We finished the job at 2:30, and I went back to Morrison.
"It was another hoax. We didn't find a thing."
Morrison ordered the students back to their classes and then took Torgerson and me to his office.
"Did you recognize the voice?" Torgerson asked. Morrison sat down at his desk.
"No, it was muffled and indistinct, just as before. But it was a male voice, that much I'm certain about."
He sighed.
Yeah, I'm having the attendance records checked anyway. Are you sure it's one of the students?
In cases like this, it usually is, Pete said. A boy decides he hates one of his teachers or the whole school because he's getting bad marks. So he uses this way to get what he thinks is revenge. Or maybe he just thinks the whole thing is a roaring joke.
The attendance records were brought to Morrison. He glanced at them and then passed them over to us.
91 absences, about average.
Pete and I went over the names of the absent students. I knew that Bob Fletcher would be there, but that didn't matter. I hoped that Lester Baines had come back to school in the afternoon.
Fletcher's here, Pete said, but he's out, of course. His eyes went back to the list.
And Lester Baines was absent. He ran down the rest of the names and then looked up and smiled.
Just Lester Baines. He's our boy.
Morrison had Lester's records brought in. He shook his head as he read.
He's 17. No disciplinary problems at all. He is absent a lot. His grades are pretty bad. He failed in 2 subjects last semester.
Pete was looking over Morrison's shoulder.
Do you know him?
Morrison smiled wanly.
No, a principal knows fewer of the students than any teacher.
Torgerson lit a cigar. This looks like the end of this one, Jim. You should look more cheerful.
I got to my feet. I just don't like to see any boy get into trouble.
We drove to the Baines home. It was a medium-sized 2-story house, much like any of the others in the block.
Mr. Baines was tall and blue-eyed. His smile left his face when he opened the door.
Oh, you here again?
We'd like to talk to your son, Pete said. Lester wasn't at school today. Is he sick?
Baines' eyes flickered, and then he said,
Why?
Pete smiled faintly.
Same thing we were here for before.
Baines let us in reluctantly.
Yeah, Lester's at the drugstore. He'll be back in a few minutes.
Torgerson sat down on the davenport.
He isn't sick?
Baines watched us narrowly.
He had a cold. I thought that it was best to keep him home today, but it wasn't so bad that he couldn't go down to the drugstore for a Coke.
Pete's face was bland.
Where was your boy at 10:30 this morning?
He was right here, Baines snapped, and he didn't make any phone calls.
How do you know that?
This is my day off. I was with Lester all day.
Where's your wife?
She's out shopping now, but she was here at 10:30. Lester didn't make any phone calls.
Pete smiled.
Well, I hope so.
And where was Lester at 1:20?
Right here, Baines said again. My wife and I will swear to it.
He frowned. Were there 2 calls today?
Pete nodded.
We sat in the living room waiting. Baines fidgeted nervously in his chair and then got up. I'll be right back. I've got to check up on something upstairs.
Pete watched him leave the room and then turned to me.
You're letting me do all the talking, Jim.
Yeah, he doesn't take 2 for something like this, Pete.
He lit a cigar. Well, everything turned out all right. We won't have to lose sleep on this one.
He picked up the phone on the table at his elbow and listened. After a while, he put his hand over the mouthpiece.
Baines is on the upstairs extension. He's calling around. He doesn't know where his son is.
Pete kept listening, and after a while, he smiled.
Now he's talking to his wife. She's at the supermarket. He's telling her about us. She's supposed to say that Lester was at home all day and made no phone calls.
I was looking out the picture window when a blonde teenage boy turned up the walk and came toward the house.
Torgerson saw him, too, and put down the phone.
There's Lester now. We'll try to have a few fast words with him before his father comes down.
Lester Baines had a new sunburn, and he carried a towel rolled up under his arm. His normal cheerful face sobered when he stepped into the house and saw us.
We're worried today, Lester, Pete said.
We know you weren't at school.
Lester swallowed.
I felt pretty rotten this morning, so I stayed home.
Pete indicated the towel under his arm.
Is there a wet pair of swimming trunks in there?
Color came to Lester's face.
Well, around 9 this morning, everything seemed okay again. Maybe I didn't have a cold. I mean, maybe it was just an allergy or something, and it cleared up.
He took a deep breath.
So I decided to go swimming, get some sun.
All day? Did you get hungry?
I took along a few sandwiches.
Who'd you go with?
Nobody, just me.
He shifted uneasily.
Was there another one of those phone calls?
Pete smiled. If you were feeling so fit, why didn't you go to school in the afternoon?
Lester's hands worked on the towel. I was gonna, but the next thing I knew it was after 1 o'clock, and I couldn't have got back in time anyway,
he went on lamely.
So I just decided to swim some more.
If you were just going to be away for the morning, why did you take the sandwiches along?
Lester's color deepened, and he finally decided to tell the whole truth. I didn't have a cold a day. I just stayed home from school. Mom and Dad don't know that. There was going to be a civics test this morning and a history test in the afternoon, and I knew I'd flunk them both. I figured that if I studied tonight, I'd be able to pass makeup test tomorrow.
We heard the footsteps coming down the stairs and waited. Baines stopped when he saw us with his son.
Don't tell them anything, Lester. Let me do all the talking.
Well, I'm afraid it's too late for that now, Pete said. Your boy admitted that he wasn't in this house today.
Lester's voice showed panic. I didn't make any of those calls. Honest, I didn't.
Baines moved beside his son.
Why keep picking on Lester?
Oh, we're not picking on Lester, but we're reasonably certain that one of the students did the phoning. However, all of the calls came during times when classes were in session, and that means that only a student who was absent could have made them.
Baines wasn't impressed.
Well, I'm sure that Lester wasn't the only student absent today.
Pete conceded that, but went on. The first of the 3 phone calls came 18 days ago. We checked the attendance records at Stevenson, and at that time and found that 96 students had been absent at the time it was made. 62 of those were boys, and we talked to all of them, including your son. Your boy was home at that time with a cold and alone. You were at work, and your wife was attending a birthday party of a friend. However, your son denied making the call, and we had to accept his word for that.
Lester appealed to his father. I didn't make that bomb call, Dad. I wouldn't do such a thing.
Baines met his eyes for a moment and then turned back to us, his face expressionless. Pete continued.
The second phone call came this morning at 10:30. We went over the attendance records again and discovered that only 3 boys had been absent on both this morning and on the day of the first phone call.
Bane's face showed a faint hope. Are you checking the other 2 boys?
We were about to do that, but then another bomb scare call made this afternoon and we were saved the trouble. We went back to the attendance records. One of our 3 suspects had returned for the afternoon session and therefore could not have phoned.
What about the other boy? Baines demanded.
He's in the hospital.
Baines grasped that.
Hospitals have phones.
Torgerson smiled faintly.
The boy caught scarlet fever while he was out of the state with his parents last weekend. He's in a hospital 500 miles away from here, and the phone calls were all local.
Baines turned to his son.
Lester paled. You know I never lie to you, Dad.
Of course you don't, son. But there was doubt on Baines' face.
The front door opened, and an auburn-haired woman stepped inside. Her face was pale, but determined, and it took her a moment to get her breath.
I just stepped out for a moment to go shopping. Otherwise, I was here all day. I'm sure I can account for every moment of Lester's time.
Mom, Lester said miserably, it's no use. I played hooky all day today, and they know it.
Pete reached for his hat.
I'd like both of you to talk to your son tonight. I'm sure you can do that much better than we can." He put one of our cards on the table. "We'd like to see all three of you tomorrow morning at 10. Outside, when he pulled our car away from the curb, Pete said, "We might find ourselves in for a hard time if they decide to keep lying for their son." "Well, suppose it wasn't somebody from the school." "Well, I hope it wasn't. But you and I know that the chances are 99 out of 100 it was." Pete sighed. "I don't like to see things like this. The bomb scare is bad enough. But what's happening to that family now? Well, that's a lot worse." I checked out of the station at 5 and got home a little after 5:30. My wife Nora was in the kitchen. "Well, I read in the paper that there was another bomb scare at Stevenson this morning." I kissed her. "And one this afternoon. That one happened too late to get into the paper." She shifted the cover off the pot roast. "Did you find out who made the calls?" I hesitated a moment. Yeah, I think we have." "Who was it?" "One of the students. A Lester Baines." Her face showed pity. "What would make him do something like that?" "Yeah, I don't know." "He hasn't admitted making the calls yet." She studied me. "You look tired, Jim. Is something like this a little worse than usual?" "Yeah, it's a lot worse." Her eyes showed worry, but she smiled. "Supper's just about ready. Why don't you call Dave? He's out in the garage trying to get that car of his to run." Dave had the carburetor on the workbench. He looked up. "Hey, Dad, you look beat with the heat." "Yeah, it was a hard day." "Find the fiend?" "Well, I hope so." Dave had the gray eyes of his mother. He frowned. "Who was it?" "Well, a boy named Lester Baines. Do you know him?" Dave peered down at the parts before him. Sure. "What kind of a boy is he?" Dave shrugged. I just know him to talk to. He seems all right." He still frowned. "Did he admit making the calls?"
"No."
Dave picked up a screwdriver. "How did you narrow it down to him?" I told him the method we had used. Dave seemed to have trouble with an adjustment. "Is he in a lot of trouble?"
"Yeah, it might turn out that way."
"What do you think will happen to him?"
"I don't know."
"He's never been in trouble before. He might get probation."
Dave thought about that.
"Well, maybe he did it as a joke. I mean, nobody got hurt. All he did was stop school for a while."
"A lot of people could have gotten hurt," I said. "It wouldn't have been a joke if there had been a panic."
Dave's face seemed slightly stubborn.
"Well, we have fire drills all the time. Everything goes off okay."
"Yes, and that was what I had counted on when I called. I didn't want anyone to get hurt."
Dave put down his screwdriver.
"Do you think Lester did it?"
"Yeah, he could have."
"Yes, Lester Baines could have made those first two phone calls, and I had made the third."
Dave was silent for a while. "Dad, when the school got the first phone call, did you talk to all the boys who were absent?"
"No, not myself, but the department got around to seeing all of them."
Dave had a faint, wry smile.
"I was absent that day, Dad. Nobody talked to me."
"Well, I didn't think it was necessary, son."
"And I hadn't. The other men's boys might have done such a thing, but not my boy." But now I waited.
Dave spoke reluctantly.
"I was absent this morning, too."
"Yeah?" I said. I met his eyes.
"And that narrowed it down to how many boys?"
"Three," I said. "But we discovered that one of them couldn't possibly have made the call. He was in a hospital out of state."
I watched Dave, and that left us with just two suspects, Lester Baines and you.
Dave had trouble manufacturing a grin.
"Some luck, huh? I was at school this afternoon when the third phone call came in, so that left just poor Lester."
"That's right. Poor Lester."
Dave licked his lips. "Is Lester's dad standing by him?"
Oh, of course. That's the way dads are supposed to be.
Dave seemed to be perspiring slightly. He worked silently at the carburetor for a minute or two. Then he sighed and met my eyes.
Dad, I think you better take me to headquarters. Lester didn't make those bomb calls.
I did.
He took a deep breath. I did it as a joke. I just wanted to pep things up. I didn't mean anything wrong.
I hadn't wanted to hear those words, and yet now I felt a pride that I had a son who wouldn't let someone else suffer for his own mistakes.
But, Dad, I just made the first two calls, not the one this afternoon.
I know.
I made that particular call myself.
His eyes widened, and then he understood.
You tried to cover up for me?
I smiled tiredly.
It was something I shouldn't have done, but a father doesn't always think too clearly when it involves his son, and I was hoping that it might turn out to be Lester after all.
Dave wiped his hands on a rag, and there were a few moments of silence.
I guess I ought to tell them I made all of those calls, Dad, Dave said. There's no sense in all of us getting into trouble.
I shook my head. Oh, thanks, son. I'll tell them what I did.
And now when Dave looked at me, I had the feeling that somehow he was proud of me, too.
We'll have supper first, I said. And then we'll phone Lester's father. A half an hour won't make much difference.
Dave smiled wryly. It will to Lester and his dad.
I made the phone call as soon as we got back to the house.
Well, all right, folks. Thank you for tuning in to the Mystery Hour. I'm Keith Tyler saying I appreciate it, and would you tune in again next time? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.